All right, ready for chapter 8, verse 22. Now, I'm going to attempt to finish chapter 8 and chapter 9 today. That's quite a bit of territory. I said I'm going to try. I don't want to do it at the expense of you not feeling like you can ask questions. You can always ask questions. I encourage you to ask questions, so I'll adjust it however I need to. But I know our time is shrinking, the amount of time that we have left in this quarter, so I just want to make sure that we cover everything, which that just simply means that we won't go as deeply on some things, but again, feel free to ask questions. Beginning of verse 22, they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him, and he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village, and when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking." Then he said to him, Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." Here we have a situation where Jesus is healing a blind man. Some people bring this man to him, and all they want is for Jesus to touch him. And that's all. They want him to be healed. And what does Jesus do? Well, what does he do first? They ask him to touch him, but what does he do? He takes him out of the city, right? Something a little bit unique, something that we haven't seen him do before. He's leading this man out of the city. And as Josh was talking about, we see a partial healing, then a full healing. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. You know, up to this point, we have seen Jesus heal people by touching them. He has healed them by people touching his garment. He has just simply spoke things. It wasn't even in their vicinity at times. So he could heal in any of these ways. But in this particular case, he takes the man by the hand and leads him out of the city. Well, why was that? This is the city that I believe it's in Matthew, that Jesus I don't know if judgment's the right word, but had talked about Bethsaida and for their unbelief. And so it's possible that Jesus just simply took this man. They brought this man to him. He took him out of the city because he was not going to do miracles in that city anymore. Because of their unbelief. There was something going on with Bethsaida, and so that's what we see happening there. He heals this man by spitting and then putting his hands on his eyes, and then he sees men as trees. And lots of questions about that. How did he know what trees look like? Why is it a partial and not a full healing? Why do you think that is? What's your answer? Garrett's back there smiling. I know he's been thinking about this. Yeah, and I hate that test, by the way. I always feel like I'm going to fail that test. I don't know why, but I feel like I'm going to fail it. All right, so that's a possible explanation. Keep in mind what we've been saying, that Jesus, everything that he does has a purpose, and it's well thought out. Okay? What had Jesus been talking to his disciples about just prior to this? You remember? About bread. right? Look at verse 18. Having eyes, do you not see? What is this story about? Having eyes, you do not see? Is it possible that he's using this as an occasion to teach his disciples? And maybe he's teaching them, maybe this is a stretch on my part, but maybe he's teaching them. At first, they see things, and we'll see this in Peter. Peter will say in just a moment who Jesus is, and then he tries to say, Jesus, no, you're not going to die. All right, so it seems to kind of fit in my mind, and that is that Jesus is giving them the picture, and they see part of the picture, but they don't see it completely clearly yet. And then Jesus heals him completely, and he sees it completely. What is his disciples thinking? What are they seeing? I don't know. I don't know if that's, again, it's just a stretch on my part, but it seems reasonable given the context. Jesus said before this, you know, open your eyes, basically. Then he gives, Mark gives this example of the healing. And then Jesus talks to them about, who do people say that I am? Do you see clearly? All right. Again, thoughts, comments on that? People that are growing, people that are improving, people that are not being satisfied with just the status quo, able to look at things differently over the course of time. Okay. Other thoughts, comments on that section? All right. Let's look in 27 through 30. Jesus went on with his disciples to the village of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? And he told them, John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets. And he asked him, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered him, you are the Christ. And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. So Jesus asked the question, who do people say that I am? Seems simple enough. I don't think it's a case where Jesus is trying to take a survey to see how he's being perceived or what people think. He's asking this for a purpose. What purpose do you think he's asking this for? Who answers him? Who answers him? Okay. Now, putting ourselves back in the context of that time, you remember this is a reasonable question that Jesus is asking because people didn't have posters, they didn't have pictures, they didn't have any of the modern conveniences that we have to be able to identify somebody. For example, when we have a gospel meeting, we have somebody coming, sometimes you'll see their picture on the flyer, or you will have seen them somewhere before, maybe you looked online and saw them presenting a lesson on the internet, and there's a lot of different ways that you would have seen them. So when they come in, you know them, right? I mean, you don't know them personally and what they're like and all those kind of things, but you can recognize them. Right? They didn't have this. And so Jesus is saying, who do people say that I am? And a big part of that was because of the activity that he had been doing. He had been healing. He'd been casting out demons. He'd been doing all these things. He'd been teaching. So who do people say that I am? And what does Peter say? You're the Christ. Now, some thought he was John the Baptist, and we talked about that last week. Why John the Baptist? Malachi talks about John has to come And so that seems reasonable. And then, you know, some say the prophets, some say Elijah. Sorry, not John the Baptist. Elijah has to come first, Malachi. And so they're kind of running down the list of potential people. But then he asked the most pertinent question. Who do you say that I am? And that's a question that every one of us has to answer. And as you're studying with somebody, this is a good point to ask that question. Who do you say that Jesus is? Now, there's two ways to answer this question. When I say two ways, there is a verbal recognition of who Jesus is, right? But it's a totally different answer when we show in our lives who Jesus is. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that, excuse me, if we recognize, really recognize who Jesus is, what are we going to do? How does that look in our lives? What does it change? If you're not a Christian, what does it change? Everything, right? It changes how you work. It changes how you talk. It changes how you act. It changes how you interact with other people. It changes your thought process. It changes everything, right? So how do you answer that question? I'm asking you, how do you answer that question? Do you just come here, but the rest of the time you live kind of a different life? Or is this you all the time? I think you know what I'm talking about. Are we, what kind of life are we living? That's the question that Jesus asked, very simple, to the point, who do you say that I am? But our answer to that, both verbally and more so in the way that we live, is pretty significant. That's, Jesus asked that question, and then he gets this response. In verse 31 through 33, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. After 3 days, rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on things of God, but on things of man." So Jesus begins the process here of preparing his disciples for what is inevitable, and that is for Jesus' death. They don't understand it, and Jesus nonetheless lays the groundwork. Now, it's interesting that Peter understood who Jesus was in verse 29, but then immediately following that, here, verse 32, Peter took him aside and rebuked him, right? And what is Jesus' response to that rebuke? What does he say to Peter? "Get behind me, Satan." Whoa. If Jesus calls you Satan, that's a wake-up call, right? Put yourself in Peter's position for a moment before we get too hard on Peter. What do you think Peter was? We don't know exactly what Peter was thinking. It's not revealed to us. What do you think Peter was thinking? Thoughts? I'm not going to allow that to happen. You know, we see Peter over and over again. He's the one that's out there. We'll see him at the Transfiguration here in a minute. He's the one out front. That's who Peter is, right? And in his mind, he's going to do everything he can to protect Jesus. And we see that later on. That's just who Peter is. But what was Peter's problem? What did Jesus point out at the end of that statement? "Get behind me, Satan." Why? What is Peter focusing on? Things of men. Is he wrong to not want his friend to die? No, you don't want your friends to die. He didn't want his friend Jesus to die. But he wasn't looking at the big picture. He wasn't seeing the big picture. Jesus knew what the full story was. And so that's why he called him Satan, get behind me, is you're not focusing on the right thing. This has to happen. Jesus knows this is what's prophesied. This is what has to happen. Yet Peter is just, I think, simply wanting to protect Jesus because he doesn't want Jesus to die. He's looking for great things. And again, we've said it many times, what are the disciples and apostles thinking? There's going to be an earthly kingdom. This is the king. He's going to rescue all of us. And they just didn't fully understand the magnitude of what was happening yet. Okay? Thoughts, comments on that section? And what Jared is saying, sorry to call him Josh because I was going to make a point with Josh. What Jared's saying is, sometimes we limit ourselves. We're afraid to say something because we like that relationship that we have and we're afraid we're going to alienate somebody. There's also occasions, let's say Josh comes to us and says, I've decided to move. I'm going to India. There's a great need for the gospel there. And so he loves Indian food, and so I knew that was safe. He doesn't like it. That's what he was going to do, right? And our human side says, no, don't go. We need you here, and we can make a case. We need you here. But there may be greater needs somewhere else, right? Our human side says, let's hang on. What we got, what we know, what we trust, what we love. And that's what Peter was doing. But yet Jesus said, focus on spiritual things. That's a hard transition to do, but it's one that we must make for sure. Okay? Verse 34. And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone comes after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And for whoever would save his life will lose it. For whoever loses his life for my sake and for the gospel's will save it. And for what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will be the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. Jesus warned them about what's going to happen there in beginning in verse 31. And now Jesus is issuing a challenge. If you want to come after me, there's three things required. One, deny yourself. Okay? Notice it said deny yourself, and it doesn't have a blank there. Typically when we talk about denying ourselves, I like chocolate, so I'm going to deny myself. Chocolate means I'm not going to have chocolate. Right? What does it mean to deny yourself, period? Very different in our concept. We think of denying ourselves of some pleasure, and when I say that, not simple things, but denying ourselves of chocolate, of a vacation, of whatever. What does it mean here when it says deny yourself? Prioritize something else first. Other thoughts? God's will is first, not ours. Christ is to live in us. And we see that in verse 35. For whoever will save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake of the gospel will save it. What is this saving our life or losing our life talking about for the gospel?
It's no longer our life that we're living to deny ourselves our own autonomy. Instead, our righteousness is living through us. And so our life is, we know it before we become Christians, is no
For so long when I read that, whoever loses his life for my sake, for the gospels, will save it. In my mind, for whatever reason, that was, if I am faced with a dilemma and somebody comes in and says, deny Christ or I'll kill you, and I'm not going to deny Christ, and they kill me, right? And so I've saved my life in that aspect. I've saved my soul because I did that. And that may be true. But what is this really talking about? Just what Garrett was talking about. Giving our life. How do you give your life? What? Submit. You submit to whom? Submit to Christ. You submit, that means you are doing what he wants, not what I want. Now, hopefully one day those two are exactly the same. I'm doing what I want because it's what he wants. But giving your life, you know, we often talk about a mother that has just given her life to her children or a child with needs. You know, you see that. You see that happening. What do we mean by that? Well, they have everything revolves around them, right? Their decisions that they make, the thoughts that they have, the care that they give, all of those things. That's what we're to be with Christ. That's how we give our life, by being dedicated to him, by the decisions that we make are based on what would he want us to do, right? How do we do that? That is the challenge. Because he then goes on to say, take up your cross. You know, the cross was not something looked on favorably. It was a method of execution. Often the person being executed would carry the cross with them. I've heard it explained a couple of ways. It wasn't the whole cross that they would leave the upper post, and then the post that they would nail them to, their hands and tie them to, either way, that's what they would carry through the street. So you can imagine carrying a big beam. Then they would take that beam, lift them up, and hang them on the cross. That seems to make sense to me in my human thinking. Exactly what it is, I don't know. What's Jesus' point here? It's not so much a physical cross. It's that suffering, right? Think about this for a minute. What does Jesus say? If anyone would come after me, deny himself, not putting yourself first, take up a cross, die for me. That's what he's saying. Follow me. What is appealing about that? Is there anything appealing about that to you? The end result. Yeah. What do you get? Right? When you first read that, it's like, whoa, this is hard stuff. This is a challenge. That's exactly what it's meant to be. Excuse me. And sometimes when people visit here and we talk to them, sometimes you almost get the impression, I'm thinking of one recently in particular, that, you know, they want to know what kind of children's programs do you have? And what kind of this program do you have? And you know, they like the aesthetics, you know, like the way the building looks, or, you know, all these things. And it's almost like an interview of, okay, what are you going to do for me? Do you see that at all in this passage? I don't see that anywhere in what Jesus is expecting. What can I do for you? Yes, I need to have that attitude. I want to help you. I want to do things for you. I want to care for you. I want to provide those things. But I'm not coming in saying, okay, what are you going to do for me? I'll come if, you know, I can get these certain things. I think it's a very dangerous thing for us in our mind. Jesus is saying, follow me, follow my example, follow my leadership, follow my direction. And don't be ashamed, there in verse 38. For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man will be ashamed. That's not the position that we want to be in. Okay? And, of course, in verse 36, what is it worth? What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Let me use this example. Romans 6, 3 through 6. Giving up ourselves, right? No longer slave to sin, being like Jesus. Excellent point.
He talks about a new life. We are to live a new life.
To be changed, right? To be different. And what's the value of that? Jesus is talking about, you know, what does a man profit if he forfeits his soul? If I could make a deal with you that I'm going to give you $100 million. You can spend it any way that you want to spend it. Do anything that you want to do with it. Would you take that deal? Would you? I forgot to mention this one caveat. Besides me not having it, but ignore that for a minute. You have until Thursday. And on Thursday, you have to give me all the unspent money back and everything else that you have. You got to give it all to me. Give me your house, your car, everything. I'll let you keep one set of clothes, but everything else, you're on the street. Does that change the way the deal looks? Would you take that one? Looked pretty good on the front end. Not so good come Thursday. What's the point? It's the value at the end, right? What value is your soul? What are you willing to give up? And people will give up for their soul for next to nothing. Nowhere near a dollar value, excuse me, of $100 million. What does Jesus want of us? What is it worth to you? Thoughts or comments on that section? Okay, chapter 9. No, I'm not going to make it through chapter 9. But and Jesus and he said to them, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste of death until they see the kingdom of God come after it has come with power. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he transfigured before them. His clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For he did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, this is my beloved son, listen to him. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. So what's happening here? In verse 1, Jesus is saying, true, there are some here who will not taste death until the kingdom of God has come with power. Some think that is talking about the coming of the church there in Acts, that we see in Acts chapter 2. Some think it may be something else, that they wouldn't taste death until they saw the transfiguration. I am not, either one of those would potentially work, but I think the point is that things are happening. Jesus said they're happening now, and you need to be paying attention. You need to be understanding what's happening, that the kingdom of God is coming with power. And then we go into the transfiguration. So basically what happens is Jesus goes up. He takes Peter, James, and John with him, and there Jesus is transformed. He glows. We've seen that before. Moses, when he went up on the mountain and got the law from God, he came down and he shone so brightly. They asked Moses to put a veil over his face. They couldn't look at him. That's what apparently is happening here. And we find Peter. Now, before we're too harsh on Peter, to a Jew, what would it mean to be able to see Moses? Since their childhood, what have they studied as a Jew? Yeah, the law. And who's the law given to? Moses. Could you imagine? You get to see Moses? And then there's Elijah. When you think about the excitement of seeing Elijah, Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind, right? Chariots of fire. Elijah was, how brave, right? The prophets of Baal, 450, and he was brave enough to withstand them, challenge them. What did he do with Ahab, right? Very brave man, very strong man of God. How impressive would it be to be able to see him? And so what does Peter do? Typical Peter. I got to say something. It's interesting, the other two, there's no record of them saying anything. What does Peter do? Let's build tabernacles. Let's build a tent. Let's build something to honor all three of them. What was wrong with that? Would you not honor Moses for what Moses did in the life that he lived? Would you not honor Elijah for the life that he lived? It wasn't that Moses and Elijah weren't great men, but they were in no comparison to Jesus. There's a lot of parallels we can draw here. Obviously, the law of Moses, the law or for the information from the prophets, very important, but they're all bowing to Jesus, right? What Jesus has to say is more powerful, more, it's hard to say more better, and my English wife would crack me over the head. The superiority of Christ. That's what Hebrews is all about. The book of Hebrews is about the superiority of Christ and better, 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 better. How many times do we read better in that book, right? And that's what God says here. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him. Then they're gone. And what does Jesus say? Coming down from the mountain, he charged them, verse 9, tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept this matter to themselves, questioning what the raising from the dead might mean. And they asked him, well, why do the scribes and the Pharisees, why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how it was written, the Son of Man, he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt. But I tell you that Elijah has come, that he did what they did to him, whatever they pleased, as it is written of him. What is this talking about? So they're coming down, and Jesus says, don't say anything about this until I've died and risen again. They didn't understand at that moment what that meant. But in 1 Peter, or 2 Peter, chapter 1, Peter recounts the transfiguration and just the significance of what this story meant to him and how important it was and how he remembered all these things. Matthew chapter 17, verse 13, we don't have time to read that, but it says that that they understood that he was talking about John the Baptist. John the Baptist was Elijah from the standpoint he had come and prepared the way for Jesus. So that is what that is describing. Questions, comments about the Transfiguration. I know I went through that pretty quickly, but that's a story that we've heard several times and have probably heard a few lessons taught about it. Thoughts, comments? Okay. Now, we switch gears again in verse 14. When they come to the disciples, and again, this is the disciples that were left behind. So there's 12, three of them are up there with Jesus, so that if you do the math, there's nine left. And what have they been doing? So now Mark addresses that. When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able." And he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought him the boy. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked the father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into the fire and into water and to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." When Jesus saw the crowd coming together, running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him, never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him up, and he rose. When he entered the house, the disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer." Interesting story, right? They brought him to Jesus because they couldn't cast him out. Why could they not cast out this demon? Were they not his disciples? Were they not strong enough? Had he not given them the power to do that? They're fussing with the scribes. What does Jesus say at the end when they ask him why they couldn't do it? They get in private. Well, why could we do it? What did Jesus say? Here. By prayer, right? In Matthew 17, verse 19, it talks about lack of faith. Here it talks about prayer. I think both of those fit, certainly. Lack of prayer. Thought about this for a bit. Could it have been that when Jesus had sent these men out, could you imagine the first time that you were able to cast out a demon? And what that must have been like. But then, as life goes on, as they cast out more demons, I don't know how many they had cast out, they'd come back and reported to Jesus all that they had done, all the healing that they had done, all the casting out they'd done. Is it possible that they just kind of just like, "I got it. Casting out demon things, done it 100 times, no problem." They bring this boy to him, and "I'm going to take care of this," and they fail. Why? They're relying on themselves. They didn't go to God and ask him. They didn't talk to him, ask for help in doing all this. They forgot where the power came from. It's possible. Now, put yourself in that position. Are the things in your life that you're like, "I got it. I don't need to talk to God about that. I'm going to handle it." Are you guilty of the same thing? I don't know if that's exactly what happened. Something like that something obviously happened, they were not able to cast this demon out. Notice the father said something interesting. If you can do anything. Whew. Saying that to Jesus. Jesus calls him on it. If? You can almost imagine that conversation. But you can see the frustration of this father. He had tried with the nine remaining apostles. They couldn't do it. And so he says, well, Jesus, if you can do it. Jesus' response again, if you can. Now, that's the problem. It's not that Jesus can't do it. It's that the Father doesn't trust Jesus to do it. That's the question. Now, notice his response. The Father says, I believe. Then what? Help my unbelief. How does that work? Either you have belief or you don't. Is that the way it works? I believe, help my unbelief. Seems contradictory, doesn't it? Why is it not contradictory? Recognizes belief wasn't deep enough. You ever heard of growth? Is that what you're striving for? Look back a year ago. Are you stronger today than you were a year ago? 2 years ago. Is your faith stronger? Is your belief stronger? That's what we're working toward. We're working toward growing. Basically, what he's saying is, I believe, but help me, Lord. Help my unbelief. Help me grow. Help me get better. Exactly what Jesus does. Yes. If you couldn't hear Caleb, what he's saying is just imagine being that father and you think you finally got the help that you need. You know that these disciples or apostles had been casting it out. Other people had been doing these things with great power and they're not able to do it for your son. Would you doubt? Would you question? And that seems reasonable in our human thinking. But Jesus challenges him and challenges him to grow. Jesus does cast out the demon. And tells it not to come back. People thought that he had died. This is the only case that, that I know of where there was a failure of healing, and it was on the apostle side, obviously not on Jesus' side. Why is that? Again, I'm not exactly sure why the apostles, other than what Jesus said, this one needs prayer, that would indicate that it didn't seem that they had prayed. Maybe they had, but there's no indication of that. Okay? Thoughts and comments on that section? All right, if you allow me just 1 minute, I know I'm going to run over, but verse 30 through 32, and I'll stop there. They went out from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand the saying, and we're afraid to ask. Here, Jesus, the second time, is telling them, this is what's going to happen. So Jesus is continuing to lay that groundwork. Here's what's going to happen. And it says, but they were afraid to ask him. Why do you think they were afraid to ask him? Jesus have a reputation of biting people's heads off when they ask him questions? Why do you think they were afraid? Have you ever been afraid to ask a question because you were afraid of what the answer was? I think that's the case here. They were afraid to ask Jesus because he was going to tell them the truth. And they didn't want to hear it. They weren't yet prepared to answer or to hear that answer. So, all right, Lord willing, we'll pick up there next week.